Thursday, November 14th. Lucky you, you're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's kind of cool and overcast, and there's snow. So I came in yesterday. There was a little bit of snow on the ground, you know, when I came into the radio station. There's no snow at my house. I'm only like 5 blocks away. I'm like,
wow. You live in a heat zone.
I live exactly. It's the Acapulco of Concord. It's that district that you didn't know about.
Global warning just for Arnie's outside.
So I heard that Ken saved me from yesterday after I had that meltdown after listening to the testimony before the House. I'm telling you, I said a bad word. And, of course, the bad word was in relationship to our bad president. Yeah. So you would forgive me for that. Anyway, on that note, before we get to our professor of government from Dartmouth College, Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department, the chair, we went to the top because I wanted to get his reaction to yesterday. And I thought it was important to get a New Hampshire perspective and an Iowa perspective, in part because this is going to bleed into the presidential campaigns no matter what.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it was interesting to me because the articles that you've posted and also the TV news, the cable news last night, they were saying the same things we were saying on the air yesterday morning. It's just astounding. These patriots in the deep state are standing up for democracy and justice. And the way I put it was, do the right thing.
Yeah,
that's the only motto you need if you're going to be president, senator in the
Here's what I would do. I would
State Department.
I would
do
show.
The right thing.
I would show that the testimony from yesterday to all the political science and government and philosophy majors in virtually every college in America, and say, think about serving your country.
Yeah.
And in part because they showed a moral compass that was just – I was so glad.
Right. And Republicans, Trump, and for many years before Trump, have always trashed government and government agencies and these bureaucrats who are just living off the government teat and trying to line their own pockets and stuff. And it turns out that just as you and I and the progressives have been saying all along, people who are working for the government are committed, patriotic, trying to do the right thing, trying to make our country better. Better for its real people, not just better for the billionaires.
Yeah.
And it's true. Here you see them. This is what they do. And another phrase besides do the right thing that I think is important to remember in this context is police, I think, established it. If you see something, say something. You know, these people were operating in secret. The president, Giuliani, and his
they saw something
Igor
and said something. the twins, whatever they are.
And if you see something, say something. It makes a difference because if you see something and you think it's wrong, it probably is.
And I'm going to bring it down to the mundane level, at the municipal level, and the city level, and the county level. You know, we always say, well, where's the cops when we need them or whatever? And then I'm thinking, on occasion, where are you? And the reason I say this is, I've told you the story, I have a little elementary school across the street, and the buses stop. And the buses stop to let the kids off. But then they have their blinking lights, and then they have the little stop sign that comes off the side of the bus. And without fail, I cannot tell you how many cars go right past the buses, right past.
Whoa.
And I'm looking at them when they don't stop.
Really?
So about 2 years ago, I got so upset. I saw them do that. I walked in the middle of the street. I put my body right in the middle of the street, and I said, hit me. And they're looking at me, and I'm going, do you see that? That's so first of all, two things happened. The bus drivers adore me. Now they think I'm like a goddess.
Yeah,
more
yeah.
importantly, the cops then started like parking in my driveway so that they could stop those cars. And the guy said, you know, Arnie, if you do that again, I might have to arrest you. I said, I would love it.
Yeah.
Arrest me for stopping cars that might hit kids. That's perfectly fine with me.
How could they even seriously think about arresting you stopping a car that should not be moving?
Well, I agree. I agree. But that wasn't technically my role. But I just want people to know that if you see something wrong, you have an obligation not only to just call a cop, but to the extent that you can do something. But if you do see something, you do really should say something. I just really believe that.
Yeah, because people have moral compasses.
Yeah.
People have the power to speak, and you don't always have to – well, first of all, you shouldn't always trust your elected officials. Trump has made that pretty clear, although most elected officials are also there because they're patriotic and want to do the right thing.
Right.
Anyway, I have to share with you this incredible story.
It's his birthday, by the way, everyone. It's Ken's birthday, so wish him happy birthday. Okay, keep going. Tell me the story. Tell me the story.
So to wish me happy birthday, Fox and Friends.
Oh, good. How lovely of them.
Had an interchange that is just incredible. They're worried. You know how they're ranting and raving about Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. And the billionaire class is really getting scared. They didn't take her and Sanders seriously as somebody who could possibly win. But now they see that there's a lot of support for the progressive wing, if you will, of the Democratic Party. They got 40% of the poll numbers. And Elizabeth Warren might actually get elected president. So they're out trashing her for this wealth tax. And people are saying that those poor billionaires might have to sell an island in order to pay the wealth tax. I just couldn't believe it. So here's the discussion. Charles Schwab is whining about Elizabeth Warren, and they ask somebody, I was surprised so many rich people were almost kind of quiet when they're attacked, but not this time. They're really going after her. And the correspondent says, if you listen to Elizabeth Warren and her proposals, I mean, they are stock market negative. Now, that's a term that you and I don't think about much, Arnie.
Wow.
It's stock market negative. Her ideas might make the stock market go down.
Really?
Because the rich
people. Not my 401k. I don't think so. I don't think
a lot of people think that if she's elected, which people put a small chance at for 2020, the stock market would fall about 25%.
Wow.
I think that's the consensus. And the other guy says, is that all? It might fall, you know, just totally crash. And this correspondent says, I know, right? It's a consensus among a lot of hedge fund titans. She names a couple of them. However, on the converse of that, if President Trump was reelected, you would see a 15% bump, they say, in the stock market.
Another fairy tale.
That's what we care about.
Another fairy tale.
Which are already at record levels, mind you, because of Donald Trump's wonderful economic policies. And the other person asks, but isn't this really class warfare? There are a lot more people who aren't billionaires. And Ms. Lee says, right, that is true. But if you think about it, you know, I would say, given the stock market records and the strong economy that we've seen over the last 2 years, I think the middle class has benefited from it.
Oh, really?
It's trickled down. She thinks it's trickled down.
Should we do the numbers for her?
To the middle class. Of course, she doesn't mention, you know, working people and people who are in the bottom 70% of, well, middle class probably is included in that. So she says they can afford it. And, yeah, that's what she would say. You know, they say we don't mind paying higher taxes. You heard Bill Gates there last week saying, okay, I'm willing to pay $20 billion in taxes. That's fine. But when it gets to $100 billion, and that's probably most of his wealth, that's when the math and calculations change.
Really? He'll pay $20 billion? Well, I'll go for that.
He would only have $9 billion left.
We can compromise. I'll take the $20. We'll give him the wealth tax. If he'll cut a check for $20, I'm happy.
Yeah.
God.
So it was pointed out to me, this guy Kilmeade says, pointed out to me, and you know this much better, a lot of these 700 billionaires that we have aren't even liquid, Arnie. So they have it in assets. Lee says, right. Kilmeade says, so what are we doing? I have to sell an island in order to pay.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's
and the woman says, or maybe it's offshore already. So he's worried that these poor, poor billionaires may their billions are not in liquid assets. So they may have to sell their secret island in the Caribbean where they stash their money.
It
unbelievable.
Is. Yeah. There's an interesting arrogance about how they behave. But I don't know. I think Bernie has asked a really interesting question. What is the value to all these billionaires? And if they were so important and so good for the economy, then how come the exact opposite is happening? We've seen the greatest inequality ever. For the last 3 years, the average life expectancy in America has gone down. We've seen, you know, an infrastructure that's been disinvested in. It's just when you look at all these things, if billionaires were a sign of success, then you would see a better economy and you'd see that there would be this roaring middle class. Instead, you see the exact opposite.
But it shows you who the Republican Party and Fox News care about. It's poor billionaires might have to sell an island.
Well, that's true.
Give me a break.
All right, everyone. I decided that we really needed to talk about yesterday, but I wanted a couple of different voices. Plus, I wanted to talk about 2020. So I thought I would do a New Hampshire perspective and I would do an Iowa perspective. Our New Hampshire perspective is from Russ Muirhead. He is the head of the government department at Dartmouth College, and he'll be joining us shortly. But, you know, I was just thinking about what Ken was saying about this conversation on Fox News, and I do watch Fox on occasion, but then I, have to avert my ears. And I saw another fascinating piece, and I always have an aside at the end of what I post on Facebook for today's show content. And my aside today is from The Verge. And it's entitled, Why is American Internet Access So Much More Expensive Than the Rest of the World? And it's based on a book by Thomas Philippon, something like that. He's the author of The Great Reversal, How America Gave Up on Free Markets. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that, you know, it is true that not only is the quality of the internet slower here, it is much more expensive here. And then I'm looking at how the rest of the world accesses healthcare in a more universal way, especially in places like Europe and in fact, even there's even greater access to healthcare in places like China. But why is everything here more expensive? There's less coverage. There's greater inequality, and we tolerate it. What is it about the American headset that thinks that this is okay? I don't quite get it. That's why the idea of the fact that internet access is so much more expensive in America than the rest of the world. And I'm like, what's our problem? All right. Speaking of things that are not our problem is our next guest. Our next guest is Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department at Dartmouth College. I posted something, Russ, in anticipation of your arrival on the set. Not only did I want to talk about the public hearings, which began yesterday, but there was an interesting article at the American Prospect, and I posted this, and it was by Robert Kuttner, a good old lefty friend of mine. And Robert's piece was entitled, Let's Hear It for the Deep State. And I think yesterday was so fascinating because a lot of us were watching people that, you know, historically we've been poo-pooing from the more progressive left side of the aisle and going, oh, my God, they're saving our, you know, our butts because
it was
remarkable. And I don't know whether I would love to sit in a classroom where you showed yesterday's testimony to a group of government students and ask them, what do you want to be when you grow up? Because I wanted to be one of those two men. That's what I wanted to be. I so admired not only their intellect, but their compass and their sense of moral outrage.
Welcome to that's right. And their care for, you know, process and the rule of law.
Yes. Yes. It was not about impeachment. It was an education for me about a government that I didn't ever quite appreciate. But yesterday I valued it in a way that I'd never quite – I mean, I understood the concept of soft power. I really do. But I'd never really seen this sort of display of soft power because that's really what you were seeing yesterday.
Yeah. You know, I think you put your finger right on it, education and civic education.
Yes.
That's what these hearings are all about. They're not – you know, they're secondarily about impeachment.
Yeah.
Their first purpose is to educate people, not only about what happened – but also about the kinds of processes that you know, democracy, constitutional democracy, requires, and the kinds of character that it requires. And, you know, there's no way that these hearings are going to cause Republicans to think that Trump should be impeached. We all know that. But I do think they might cause Republicans to think that Trump did something inappropriate and wrong, something that shouldn't be set a template for future presidents. Something that's out of bounds, and that's actually, I think, the most important purpose.
So let me tell you my biggest concern, and that is that whether we look back at Mueller and, you know, Trump, you know, basically saying, Russia, if you're listening, and then we look at this, and then it's the shakedown of the sort of the young, new, inexperienced Ukrainian president, again, looking at dirt on Joe Biden. I mean, the only corruption he cares about is corruption that will aid and abet his ultimate reelection in 2020. So it's not about corruption. It's, once again, like Ukraine, if you're listening, whether it was Russia, if you're listening. And here's my biggest concern. Is that we have so polluted politics in America. We have so overwhelmed it with dark money and the ability to buy and sell congressional seats and the influence and the overarching influence of lobbying and the consequences of politics. And I just feel like in a lot of ways, we don't value elections anymore. We don't think – we see them as cesspools. We don't see them as clean. We see them as master manipulators. We see it about money. We see it about people marginalizing and distorting records of other people. It isn't about a choice. It's about a war. And to a large extent, what Donald Trump has done, whether you read it in the Mueller report or you see it here with the whistleblower report, it goes to the fact that we have really stained our political process and that elections are so unhealthy.
I worry that against that sort of background where people just assume that money has almost completely corrupted the political process.
Yes.
My students just assume that that's a basic, you know, a fact, that there's no point in arguing it. And what I worry about is that we'll lose hold of a couple really elemental norms or commitments that, you know, democracy absolutely requires. Here's an example. When the people in power lose an election, we need them to peacefully turn over power to the winners of the election.
Right.
And so far, in spite of all the corruption that's happened since, you know, since Citizens United, that's always happened. The losers of elections, when they're in power, turn over power to the winners. Whether it was, you know, Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, this just was unquestioned. You know, if we really lose faith in democracy, I think we will no longer expect people to do that. And that's what I'm worried about.
So as we look at what is sort of the foundation that was being laid yesterday, and obviously we'll be going through a couple of weeks of hearings, and it really is going to be an interesting test for the U.S. Senate. I think it really will, because we know that the Democrats control the House. But what I'm trying to figure out is that if you're running for president right now, how do you run with this as your backdrop? And the reason I say that is Mark Sanford just decided to step away from the race. And one of the reasons he said, as a Republican,
Is he going hiking again?
That's right. I wonder what trail. But anyway, but
you gotta love the guy.
Yeah, you gotta love his chutzpah. I mean, the guy is just unbelievable. You know, this is the first time he's really exited left. I mean, or stepped off the stage, because he keeps coming back. But he said that part of the reason why he decided to step away from running in the GOP race is because that the impeachment is such a distraction. Well, obviously for the Republicans, everything is a distraction because they're going to get no traction. That's to be honest here. But for Democrats, how do they talk about this, even though they need to focus on the issues and the policies of the day? Because it really is so much bigger than just the removal of Donald Trump. It is about the test of our sort of democratic institutions. And what do they bring to the table as they run for president? Because policy matters, but function and form matters too.
Right, right. I mean, just like, you know, the process of democracy, the idea that people in power shouldn't use their power to advance their personal ends,
right,
to you know, investigate their political opponents. This is basic. And, you know, I think that all of what I hope is that with this in the background, the Democrats remember and really never lose sight of the fact that it's not about, you know, whether it's Elizabeth Warren or Bernie or Joe. It's about beating Trump. It's about saving constitutional democracy. It's about the regime. And I hope it tempers the zeal with which they take out the knives and try to slice into each other, because that's not the point of this campaign.
Yeah, but look what we have. We've got Bloomberg showing up and maybe skipping the first two primaries and two caucuses because he can, because he doesn't care about being on the debate stage.
Hey, it worked for Giuliani.
I know, it worked for you. Exactly. So,
I'll show up in Florida.
I'll show up in Florida. Yeah, but Giuliani does not have $53 billion.
He may now.
That's right. But the Russians may be paying him. But Bloomberg, I mean, we just did a fascinating interview with a guy named Robert Henley. Robert Henley had been covering Mayor Bloomberg every single day for the 12 years he served as mayor of New York. He knew everything about his entrance. He knew, I mean, and it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. It really, he's such an interesting figure, even as mayor, let alone what he did since being mayor. And yet what scares me is that the conversation that took place in May between Bezos and Bloomberg, where Bezos says, you know, Mike, maybe you want to run for president. And of course, at that point in time, they thought Biden would sort of save them. And now they're just really terrified. terrified that, you know, the Warrens and the Bernies actually have some traction and have some real cachet with the base of the party, and God forbid they enter, you know, into the Oval Office. But what I'm trying to figure out is, and then you got Deval Patrick. Deval Patrick is filing today. I'm just trying to figure out what message has come out of the conga line of candidates that have been running that suggest to these individuals that there still aren't enough choices out there, and none of them will satisfy the base, let alone take out Donald Trump.
Right. It really is. I mean, like, we needed a few more candidates. But don't you think it's the failure of Joe Biden to consolidate his support? I mean, Joe Biden is a sort of likable centrist, and he's the one who can prevail in a general election. That's the whole rationale for his candidacy. And it turns out that every time he opens his mouth, whether he's talking about record players or whatever, he loses support. And I think it's causing alarm, not just among the billionaires who don't like Elizabeth Warren, but about all from, you know, among all those who really think that winning the general election is general election in a way that can command support from disaffected Republicans and center right independents.
Well, do you think, Russ, that it's because of Biden's way of speaking, his personality, whatever, or is it really because he is not articulating any positions that are very different from what you would have called moderate Republicans? You know, he's like Clinton.
Well, no, he's a throwback to 25 years ago.
He's Clinton. Deregulation is the way to make our economy better. You know, the era of big government is over, and trashing government bureaucrats, we need to just get rid of them, make them smaller. And these are the people who are
showing. Is that what Biden's
showing,
really saying? I don't know what Biden. You know what the problem is? I don't know what Biden is running on. No, I'm going to be honest with you.
That's what Clinton was saying.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Right. Yeah. That is the idea. And, you know, but you see, I'm going to tell you what I think is the problem. And nobody wants to say it out loud. So Biden is not as, you know, although he is number one in the polls and one of the last polls, that seems to be an aberration. But who is number one in the polls in Iowa? Mayor Pete. So what's fascinating to me is Mayor Pete really has filled the expectation that Biden was going to be able to sort of bring these different parties together. Yeah. He was going to call. But Mayor Pete scares a lot of people, too, only they won't say it out loud. He's very, very young. He doesn't have any cachet with the base of color, in at least at this point in time. He, you know, he was the mayor. I mean, he's clearly an interesting, remarkable young man, but I'm not sure he's ready for prime time when it comes to being president. And it's easier to say I'm jumping in because Biden is so weak, or they also jumping in because Pete is getting so much stronger, and they don't think he has the capacity to take it not only to the minority voters in America, but actually take on Trump.
Well, how about foreign policy? Pete doesn't have any foreign policy experience, and you see from what the reason this whole impeachment is taking place is foreign policy is important.
Oh, he'd be a great Secretary of Defense, though.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I don't think anyone says Pete's name, but they do say Biden, and I don't think Biden is really what's scaring them. What's scaring them in a lot of ways is Pete, because he definitely is a very exciting candidate. The question is, will the excitement not only deliver for a base that needs to come out, but more importantly, to defeat Donald Trump? Mm.
I mean, more so than in any election that I'm going to guess that any of us can remember, what Democrats care about is winning the general, and they really don't want to indulge themselves. They want to win the general election to save the regime, and I think, you know, they're looking at Warren. It's not they don't like Warren. They just worry that she's not going to appeal in the general election. They look at Pete. And, you know, they like a lot about him. They just worry he's not going to win.
Exactly.
I think that's what's really striking fear. It's not the individual, what they stand for, their policies, their absence of policies. It's just, can they win?
But what's their reason for thinking that Biden-type person is the one who can win? You know, Elizabeth Warren is someone who can't win. Of course, beating Trump in the general is the most important thing. But why do we think we have to be so cautious and say nothing so we don't alienate anybody and don't rock the boat and the stock market stays high and all of that? you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is an answer to that, but you're right. I think it might be a misplaced answer. And listen, I mean, the idea was, I guess, of 4 or 5 months ago, this was Biden's virtue, that he could win in the general election. Mm-hmm. He knew how to appeal to the various groups that make up the Democratic constituency, and now he's worrying us too, because he's shown to be, you know, shown himself to be weaker than we anticipated.
So without
confidence in Biden, Warren, Buttigieg, and others, Democrats are going into mild panic.
They're flailing. So let me ask a question. How do you win? Do you win because you think you have what's called, quote unquote, an electable candidate? Or do you win because you have a candidate that brings out a level of excitement and passion of the base, which is an expanding base, unlike the GOP base, which is a dying and contracting base? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, what is the strategy for winning? And when I'm looking at the kind of safe candidates they want, I see safe as really basically sort of saying to the base, screw you. There's what level of excitement gets, I mean, I don't get excited about wallpaper. I'm sorry, art I get excited about. Wallpaper I don't. And what I see the Democrats looking for is wallpaper. You know, and that may be safe and it may cover a lot of holes. I'm not sure it delivers the winning strategy for 2020. 2018 was a huge turnout election because the base got excited. 2020, if you give me something tepid and safe, I think there's a level of disgust that says screw you.
Yeah, I mean, look, we do have in the Democratic Party a much more diverse coalition than the Republicans have right now. All minorities have been driven out of the Republican Party, all the Hispanics, all the blacks to speak of, and many of them are socially conservative. So that means that in the Democratic coalition, there's a lot of socially conservative traditionalists, sort of moral traditionalists. And that means that the Democratic nominee has to appeal to basically a broader range of views than the Republican nominee has to appeal to. And it requires a kind of, I'd say, a radically capacious, loving, inclusive, and wise person to appeal to those very many different types that make up the cacophony of the Democratic Party.
See who you just described to me? Can I tell you who you described to me? Cory Booker.
Who?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No. Oh, my God. I mean, I hate to say this, and I have a lot of issues with Cory. Trust me. I can go through the conga line of issues where I think, oh, my God. But as you were just talking, every time I hear Cory Booker, I see this smorgasbord of America finding a space in his language, finding a place in his head, realizing he understands them. Maybe it's because of Newark. Maybe it's because of he's just such an interesting character. And yet, look what's happening. Deval Patrick is jumping in, and I'm thinking, what do you offer, Deval, that Cory didn't offer? In multitudes, on steroids. And yet,
neither. Need either of these two candidates. I think that's pretty plain.
Can I just say, Russ, I've been saying to Arnie for a long time and on the show that I think that Cory Booker, as the running mate of Elizabeth Warren, gives you the best of both worlds, gives you a progressive agenda that actually has the courage to reach out to real people and not just the billionaires and corporations, and at the same time have Cory's heart and real authentic voice for
human beings. His life experience is just also incredible. And so at some point in time, we're going to have to, when this is all over in 2020, I want to do some kind of an analysis of, you know, why did people succeed and why didn't? And of all the people that's sort of shocking to me, it's that Cory Booker did not succeed. Because
let's not count him out.
All right, so I'm not
crazy.
Who
knows what'll happen in Iowa? Stranger things have happened.
That's Iowa for you. All right, thank you so much, Russ Muirhead. I really appreciate it. Take care.
What a pleasure.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye. Russ Muirhead is the head of the Dartmouth Government Department. He joined us on The Attitude. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1978. That was the day OSHA published its lead standard. The standard reduced the permissible exposure by 75% to protect nearly a million workers from damage to nervous, urinary, and reproductive systems. As early as 1908, Alice Hamilton, the mother of occupational medicine, noted that lead had endangered workers as far back as the first half century after Christ. In their book, Deceit and Denial: The Deadly Politics of Industrial Pollution, Revolution, historians Gerald Markowitz and David Rosner add that, throughout her distinguished career, Hamilton was deeply involved in uncovering the relationship between lead and disease in the American workforce. Hamilton's groundbreaking research on the effects of lead paved the way for a growing uproar against its continued use. After the Occupational Safety and Health Act passed in 1970, occupational and public health activists pushed hard for a lead standard. A new generation of industrial hygienists emphasized how unsound industry-driven conclusions regarding safe lead levels impacted women workers and workers of color. Industry had long asserted that women and African Americans were simply more susceptible to lead poison, which served to justify discrimination in hiring. Some unions accepted these terms, if only to demand a stringent lead standard that included immediate implementation of engineering controls. But leading hygienists like Gene Stelman blasted these arguments. Stelman insisted such conclusions reflected racial and gender bias rather than any credible scientific evidence. She added that men, women, and children, regardless of race or ethnicity, were all adversely affected by lead exposure. The final standard adopted was considered a compromise. Discrimination in hiring has continued and enforcement proves difficult. But even a watered-down standard was too much for the lead industry. They have been fighting it ever since.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The vast tropical forests of Colombia contain an immense amount of carbon, but they're being cut down at a rapid rate. So protecting and restoring these forests is an important way to slow global warming. In 2017, the country implemented a plan to encourage forest protection while also reducing carbon pollution. It starts with a carbon tax on liquid fossil fuels.
It will incentivize companies to use less fossil fuels because now they have to pay tax on them. It's more expensive.
That's Sebastian Treng, executive vice president at the nonprofit Conservation International. He says some of the tax revenue funds projects that protect forests. What's more, companies get a tax break if they take the initiative to reduce carbon pollution. Many have therefore invested in reforestation projects. Colombia generates less than 1% of the world's carbon pollution. But Treng says its carbon tax model
highlights the potential that other larger economies have to put similar systems in place that would be tremendously beneficial, both in terms of driving down emissions from industry and in terms of supporting conservation and restoration efforts for our remaining forests.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Kind of fun. I know they should have a musical entree before they begin any of those impeachment hearings. Wouldn't that be kind of fun? Everyone gets to pick a song. I would love to see this. This is The Attitude with Artie Arnaz and producer Ken Barnes. Picks our music. Who sings Shame, Shame, Shame?
That is Shirley and Company. And I think that the Republicans and the Donald are shame, shame, shame.
Yeah, exactly. It's a shame that we elected him. And on that note, joining us from the great state of Iowa is Professor Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known known as Dr. Politics, from Iowa State in Ames. And are you excited? Deval Patrick is filing for president today in New Hampshire. Have you been waiting for Deval? Have you been, like, calling him up saying, hey, we need one more candidate. Don't you think you should be running? Oh, God, Stefan, what the heck is going on?
Yeah, the people of Iowa said to me, and it's happening, they said, we want the fourth richest man in the world to run, because we need another rich guy running in the Democratic Party. And we need Hillary Clinton to consider running, because she won the last election. And so, you know, she might actually get the electoral votes this time. And then we need another African-American who is on the board of private equities.
Bain.
So the answer is, it's wonderful that the field is growing again, because it was too small.
Well, you know, there must be something in the water, though, in Massachusetts. We have, I mean, think of all the governors from Massachusetts that thought that they should be president. In fact, we got a guy running on the Republican ticket, I believe. Bill Weld was a former governor of Massachusetts. Deval Patrick, a former governor of Massachusetts. The guy that's now the senator from Utah, the former governor of Massachusetts. I wonder what's in that water. I'm just trying to figure out. It's kind of amazing, you know.
And they all are winners. They all became president.
That's right. Yeah, I guess they don't have the electability gene.
Well, my friend who was the North American, actually U.S. political editor of The Economist, he came to Iowa frequently in the last cycles of presidential caucuses. And he always said to me, he said, you know, people from the Acela corridor just can't win.
Oh, yeah. That's a great...
And the Acela corridor, for those of you from southern Mississippi, is the Amtrak train that runs from Washington, D.C. through New York to Boston.
Yeah.
And you know, that area has not really been able to capture the White House. And so now we have, as you said, a whole bunch of people running from that general area, including Bernie Sanders, frankly, who is... You know, might as well be from Massachusetts. And is it a wonder, Arnie, then, that people are saying, maybe we need somebody else running, because that field doesn't look like it's going to be able to defeat Donald Trump?
I think we're just panicking. We just start to rust Muirhead from Dartmouth College. And I think the problem is that, you know, right now we're so desperate to replace Donald Trump that we want someone who we know will be electable. And unfortunately, there are 5,000 different positions on what defines electability. I mean, it's a Rorschach test. Electability is a Rorschach test. It depends on who you're talking to, at what moment, and they will give you a completely different answer, which is one of the reasons why we have a variety of candidates. So I guess I have to ask the question. The most recent poll coming out of Iowa puts Mayor Pete in the lead. The most recent poll in New Hampshire now puts Biden back in the lead. So I'm kind of curious. Explain to me what's happening on the ground in Iowa. I'll be honest with you, I can't explain what's happening on the ground in New Hampshire. I will be brutally honest here. I don't know how Biden leapt to the lead, but, you know, that's something else that needs to be explained to me. But explain Pete to me.
Look, polls are a very sort of flexible, changeable, short life kind of indicator. You know, the shelf life of a poll could be overnight. If something happens, the poll would look different tomorrow. So I would say that it's an indication of a kind of sort of neurotic behavior by these are mostly Democrats who are likely primary voters in New Hampshire or caucus attendees voters in Iowa. And, you know, I would say these polls may still flip around some, you know. We're still a few months away from the caucuses. The caucuses are not the end of the world. You know, there's still months and months and months where candidates can race around the country trying to convince people they're the one, and Barack Obama did that. He went to the last place on earth where there are still some Democratic delegates to the Democratic convention to be harvested, which is, you know, Guam and Puerto Rico. And he finally got enough people to pledge, so he got the nomination. So I would say let's be patient
Mayor Pete, look, I just wrote a short little response to someone who was doing a big article on Mayor Pete. And I said, look, he has interviewed very well. I mean, he's interviewed, he's one of the most, calm and focused, sensible, and intelligent of all the candidates. Yeah. He doesn't wave his arms. He doesn't, veer off into the woods, chasing some dream. And that has helped him, I think, with a lot of people who are worried, that the Democratic Party might move too far into the woods, especially on the left. Biden is a different story, Arnie. I don't know. I guess voters in New Hampshire maybe think that someone with that experience and who is sort of in the middle might be the best choice. But,
so what's happening to Kamala? Kamala pulled up everything and moved to Iowa. Every time I think that, I'm like, oh, it's over. I mean, when you made that sort of commitment to a place, and I'm just trying to figure out, is there any strategy there for her?
Not really much. I mean, you don't see where she's going to move in the polls by investing a huge amount in Iowa.
Yes.
And in the past, we've had desperate candidates literally move to Iowa and rent a house, send their kids to the local school for months, and it didn't make any difference. So her problem, I think, is that she's smart. She is should be appealing to women voters and women answering the polls, but she just isn't getting anywhere. And I think you remember her demise started, Arnie, when she went after Joe Biden.
Yeah, exactly.
On busing and stuff like that. And a lot of people said, we shouldn't be attacking each other yet. Let's try to keep the tribe together. And also, she was tough on law enforcement, I think, in California, and that has hurt her with African American with black voters.
Oh, but what I feel bad. What hurts her is that she is law enforcement because she was the attorney general. It's such a difficult needle to thread. We need to bring more people of color into the police force. We did a phenomenal interview with a guy from Arizona State the other day about policing for profit and about when you see a high relationship between a significant minority population and a very white police population. You see a changing pattern in policing, and it's not for the better, it's for the worse. So it's almost like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. If you are a black woman who is in some ways the biggest police chief because she's the attorney general, then they say, you didn't do enough for us. But then you're angry when you realize that there aren't enough black folks within the police department or the attorney general's office or places of authority where they could really make a difference. It's so, so hard to figure out what the balance is and how to convince people, I'm not going to be perfect, but at least look what I did, and I did try to make a difference.
She doesn't say that very well. You just said it probably more effectively, I think, than she has. So she hasn't made the case for herself. She hasn't stepped forward and said, look, we have to go after people who are breaking the law. And a lot of that is happening not in the suburban white neighborhoods where people have gated communities and private security systems.
Right.
It's happening in the places where Latinos and Latinas and African Americans and other immigrants
vulnerable.
Are living.
Right.
And so she hasn't made that case. She has not come forward and defended herself effectively. So I think that accounts for the fact that she's not moving in the polls.
Yeah.
But then look, Arnie, there are a whole bunch of people who are not moving in the polls in the Democratic Party, and most of them, or many of them, are, I think, pretty smart people with pretty good experience. They're just not good communicators.
No, and let me just say one more thing, and that is we talked about this at the very, very beginning when there were 20 candidates, and that is we don't have the capacity to be able to make a judgment on that many people. You can't have it. If you have more than six or seven, then anything after that becomes sort of, you know, in the atmospherics. And that is part of the problem. It's not that there aren't good people. Every person that ran of the 20 were, for the most part, very good people. Just too many choices. Once you have too many choices, guess what? A lot of good people are expendable because you can't hold on. And then the media ultimately ends up sort of deciding it. Bernie got decided in 2016, which gave him the cachet for 2019. Biden got decided when he, you know, became the vice president for Barack Obama. That gave him the cachet. And then there are a few others who managed to sort of figure out what the strategy was. But you can't have 20 strategies. You can only have seven.
Can I?
Well, that's right. And I think,
Stefan, you know, you were talking about how Biden centrism must be what's appealing to people in New Hampshire. And you were talking about Kamala a lot, about why she's not rising in the polls despite her quality. But Elizabeth Warren is rising, has risen in the polls and demonstrated her quality and her ability to communicate to some extent as well, maybe not as glibly as Pete does, because Elizabeth's talking about actual substance and Pete sort of is not really. But that aside, I don't think the people I talk to in New Hampshire are not – they don't find Biden's centrism to be appealing. Not appealing to them necessarily.
Who you hang out with, Ken? Come on!
No.
I have to break it to you.
No. I'm just saying they don't so much find what Biden himself as appealing, but they're afraid that other people might. People might be afraid of Elizabeth Warren. You know, so in the general election, the people in the Rust Belt might not support Elizabeth Warren, and so they might love Joe Biden. But to be fearful, to have your decision on who you vote for based on a fear that not you, but somebody else might not like them, I don't think is the best way to make your decision. And the other side of the coin is the fearful caution from the centrists of, gee, we better not rock any boats, especially on Wall Street, if we want to win the general election. I don't know that that is necessarily the best strategy for Democrats either. Elizabeth Warren has been speaking to real people's real interests, and it seems to be resonating. That's why she makes those speeches and then her poll numbers rise. So, you know, the Republicans demonize her and Pete demonizes her, but she's actually, to tell the truth, instead of just be silent and say, oh, gee, vote for me because I'm not Donald Trump, that may be a strategy for Democrats to win.
Stefan?
Well, maybe. Your comments are intelligent and interesting. I would say we need to remember something. They were good comments. And I think we're missing a metric that I would like to just quickly mention, and that is likely primary voters, and certainly in Iowa, likely people who go to caucuses are middle and upper class, more educated, with either better jobs or a fairly decent retirement fund and pension than the people who don't participate. And so people who end up being asked questions, for the most part, these people have health insurance. For the most part, these people worry a little bit about giving up their health insurance. And I think that's beginning to really hurt Elizabeth Warren. And that's why Mayor Pete is saying, well, yeah, we can have Medicare if you want it. Well, you know, you can have that insurance that's like Medicare. If you have a health insurance policy that you are happy with and that you like, go ahead and keep it, which is more or less what Obama was saying. Mm-hmm. And I think that's beginning to connect. People are a little concerned about what would happen if private health insurance, their own insurance policies, were to be taken away and replaced by a government program. I mean, I think that's why her numbers are not really growing very much, frankly.
So one of the problems I have is you're absolutely right. That is the demographic, especially in Iowa and in New Hampshire, of what is going to participate in the caucus. They are the haves, not the have-nots. I mean, let's be honest. And they have insurance, and they have decent jobs, and they're engaged. They're retired. And yet, I guess one of the things, and this goes to the strength of Mayor Pete, not necessarily to the message of Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete brings a moral compass to the table. He has brought religion back into a conversation in a way that is both interesting and not offensive. I would love to be able to have an Elizabeth Warren bring it in this way, and that is the sense of generational ethics. I am so glad you have insurance. What about your grandkids? I am so glad that you have a pension plan or a decent 401k. What about the kids who are now coming out, millennials, with more of an education than you, and they're guaranteed to earn 20% less? What about them? And at some point in time, play the sort of moral card, but do it in a way that says, I get what you have, but look what most of us don't. And in the end, is just you having it what you want for the future of your country? Why can't they say that?
Yeah, no, and you know, that's a ethically, morally, a very defensible argument. Remember, people generally can't really think that far ahead generationally. People are living, you know, not day to day, but certainly concerned about the short run of their lives. And you tell them, give up your health care.
No, Stefan, let me just stop you. We are not saying to one single human being, we're saying give up your insurance. We are not saying give up your health care. This is the irony of all this. As someone who has lost her health care so many times, who couldn't afford COBRA, I don't like insurance. I hate insurance. Insurance to me is about no. Insurance to me isn't about yes to a doctor. It is about no to some kind of operation or test or whatever, or I'm in the network or not in the network. And at some point in time, that's where you have to, I think Elizabeth Warren has to say to them, I am not saying no to health care. I am saying yes so that more of us get health care. All I am saying is, are you wedded to that for-profit company or are you wedded to your health care? What is it you want? An insurance company or a doctor? An insurance company or a hospital? An insurance company or your teenage kid knowing that they can go to a doctor when they're sick, or your grandkid? What is it that you are wedded to? Is it really insurance? How come she can't say that?
Well, because the answer probably would be, well, my, you know, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or whatever it is, pays for, I do a copay, but it pays for most of my lab tests and doctor visits, and when I have surgery, if I have a really good policy, it'll pay for that. And so insurance and healthcare for a lot of people are synonymous, and for, you know, people who don't have it, there's always the emergency room, right?
Right, right. No, it is so interesting, because I go back to all the fighting at the very beginning about the Affordable Care Act and how it was so demonized. And then once it went into effect, nobody wants to get rid of it. You know, I think about all these things. It's we are afraid of the unknown. We are afraid of what we will lose because we can't imagine what we will gain. And in America, we live with an inability to imagine it cheaper, better, more accessible. I think the article at the bottom of the form that I sent you today was about how come the internet access is so much cheaper virtually everywhere else in the world but here. How come the quality and the speed of internet access in Europe is so much better and cheaper than here? We can't even imagine it, and therefore we don't demand it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. The unknown is always something to be concerned about and somewhat afraid of. So, and people are hearing things, you know, from their Canadian friends. I have a lot of Canadian friends. You know, the Canadian healthcare system is pretty good, but, you know, for most things, you have to wait a long, long time if you ever get it. And so, you know, for people who want something done right away and have a good health insurance policy, it happens right away.
Right, right. It's going to be fascinating. All right, last but not least, since the impeachment hearing was yesterday.
It was terrific.
What do you think about, I mean, what's the GPS to moving forward on this? How do we build on this? And is there going to be some kind of refrain that the Democrats can do? Because in the end, repetition is very important. Donald Trump is very good at the repetition. What would be the repetition line for the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think there is any way the Democrats can convince a highly politicized, unified Republican establishment and Senate establishment in particular to vote to actually convict President Trump. Probably the House will impeach him and file articles of impeachment, but they will fizzle out in the sand of the Senate. And, you know, I think partisanship is now so hardened that most Republicans looking at this will not be convinced that President Trump did anything with his phone calls, and, you know, he shouldn't have had a phone call with the ambassador to the EU. And most people don't understand why not, you know. It's so complicated. It seems simple, but it is actually complicated. And I've talked to a lot of people in several states where I've gone to conferences and stuff. And these are not professors, by the way. These are people like the doorman or the, right, you know, the woman in the you know, the restaurant or something. And they don't understand it. No. It's complicated.
Yeah. No. And again, what we have done is we have so dumbed down what we serve up, whether it's getting rid of social studies, whether it's getting rid of civics, whether there's an expectation of reading newspapers, whether now you have so many choices that you can always avoid the news and information. I mean, that's, you know, remember when it used to be, you know, Channel 2, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 7? There was like, we all would come together and watch the news together. There's nothing we do together anymore. And
no,
I think
you can watch. Fox will tell you that this is all fraud and a witch hunt and a hoax, and they'll stick with President Trump until the ship goes down. To me, it seems that, you know, he was really going outside the range of normal policymaking and endangering the credibility of American diplomats and having his people, his supporters, demean these two very smart individuals, you know, Mr. Kent and Taylor. And they were so disciplined, you know. They were sitting there listening often to ridiculous, ignorant questions or comments from people asking them questions, and they never flinched, and they never lost their temper. I thought that was remarkable.
Well, I wrote last night that if I could be reincarnated, I would want to come back as a Kent or a Taylor. I mean, I was so impressed with both of them. It was like, wow, why didn't I consider foreign service? You know, honest to God, in a way. And I said to Russ Muirhead at the first half of the show, I said they were the definition of soft power. Now you understand why you don't want to resort to what happens with the military and with weapons. What you want are strong, thoughtful, smart, committed people who are truly passionate. I mean, the love of Ukraine that I saw on that stand, it was really love. You know, they loved America, but they also understood that by loving and protecting Ukraine, they could not only help Ukraine, but they could protect us. And on that note, Stefan Schmidt, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week. Ciao.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, everyone, we're going to end with?
We're going to end with Trump's theme, Liar by Queen.
Here we go.
I have sinned, dear Father. Father, I have sinned. Try and help me, Father. Won't you let me in?